You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. One of the stars in the Orion constellation has been acting a little funny lately. Now astronomers think something big may be about to happen, and we might get to see it. We'll get the details coming up. Now the Wisconsin Elections Commission is split over how to proceed with a judge's order to remove more than 200,000 registered voters from the state's voter rolls. The commission met on Monday and split 3-3 along partisan lines. Republicans wanted to take many of those names off, but the Democrats on the panel blocked that from happening. It was the second time in as many weeks that the commission failed to reach a consensus on the issue. This all started in October when the Elections Commission sent postcards to people it thought might have moved. If they didn't respond, the commission planned to remove them from the rolls in 2021. Conservatives said under state law, those names should be dropped sooner, so they sued. Last month, an Ozaukee County judge agreed with them and demanded the commission act accordingly. Sean Johnson is WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Rob.
Well, as of right now, January 1st, what is the status of the people on this list of people who might be dropped?
The status is that they have not been dropped yet, that the State Elections Commission, which is the body that would need to, you know, carry out that judge's order, that those names be removed or purged from the voter list. The commission has voted a couple times, 3-3, on how to proceed. And so you can't have a 3-3 vote and accomplish anything. There has to be a bipartisan vote on that commission to take any action. They haven't gotten there yet. And, you know, until they do, we're kind of at a standstill.
Let's take this a step at a time now. The original idea is, as I understand it, Sean, hey, let's clean up our voter rolls. Some people move and they don't, you know, you don't notify the voting commission that you've moved necessarily till the next election. So how do they try to figure out who moved and then figure out if they were still there?
Yeah, they've got this multi-state system that checks a variety of government records to look for people who potentially have moved. And so it's checking things like Department of Motor Vehicle records and to see if addresses that people list for a driver's license differ from the one they use to register to vote. And through that system, which you might hear referred to in, over the course of this lawsuit as ERIC, it is, you know, that's how they flagged these 230 plus thousand names as having potentially moved. And back in October, the State Elections Commission sent a mailing to those people letting them know that they were flagged as having moved. But that mailing did not tell them that they would be removed from the list. And the state's plan was actually to not completely purge that list of 230 plus thousand voters until 2021.
And in this lawsuit now, the argument is, no, you don't get to put it off that long, right? What is the basis of this legal challenge that, that led to this conversation?
Yeah, the legal challenge, which was brought by a group of plaintiffs and handled by the conservative Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, argues that once the state sends out that notice, if people don't update their information within 30 days, they are automatically removed from the list. So it's been 30 days since that mailer was sent out. You know, the judge in Ozaukee County looked at the case after that time period had passed, and so they're arguing that the state Elections Commission does not have that discretion, that it is required that under the law that they take the names off now.
Now, the commission, the Democrats on this commission, I understand, Sean, are saying, well, hold on, this is being appealed, so let's not take this off. What's the argument over the timing now that this Ozaukee County judge has ruled?
Yeah, I mean, I think the argument at this point from the Democrats is that this is going to be decided by a higher court, so we don't need to jump into action just yet because this is in federal court. This is before the State Court of Appeals, and there's been a petition by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty to take this directly to the state Supreme Court, who would have the ultimate say anyway, and the state Supreme Court is you know, entertaining that possibility. So the Democratic members of the commission are saying, let's wait on that. We don't need to, you know, jump to any conclusions here. We need, you know, we're going to need more information on a higher court's read of this law, because earlier this year, the Elections Commission, on a bipartisan vote, you know, you had the Republican and Democratic members of the commission all saying, let's not remove people from the voter list right now. We tried this back in 2017, and it didn't go so well. So they were kind of looking at their past experience, and the system before had some errors. They wanted to avoid that. And so earlier this year, they were all on the same page. Let's wait. Now it's developed, though, into more of a partisan. Republicans have taken one stand and Democrats another.
Talking to WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about this ongoing legal saga over a group of a couple hundred thousand voters in Wisconsin who could be removed from the voter registration rolls. Sean, if this is done now, has anybody talked about if you remove people from the rolls and then a higher court says, wait, hold on, can you unremove them?
I suppose you could. Anytime you make changes like that, it gets a little bit tricky. We do have, we're looking at this on a national scale anyway, because Wisconsin is so important in the national race for president. Because of the electoral map, because it's such a close state, this is all under a much bigger spotlight than it would be in another state that's deeply red or deeply blue, where a couple hundred thousand votes aren't going to potentially swing the presidency. I think you just got to say from the outset that that's why this is getting so much attention. If the state were to act, you could potentially undo what had just happened. But there is another less watched election that's coming right around the corner. There is a February primary for the state Supreme Court race in April. So, just kind of the mechanics of the election are about to get moving here. And so it would be hard to undo something in the middle of that February election cycle.
Now, you mentioned this could go to this, will likely go to the state Supreme Court. Did I hear you say there's also a federal challenge going on here?
There is. There was a federal challenge by the Wisconsin League of Women Voters basically to block the initial state court decision. And also one of the issues that the League of Women Voters raised in federal court is that mailing by the State Elections Commission back in October to these people who were flagged as having moved, that mailing told them, we're not going to remove you from this list. And so if the state were to do that, if the state were to follow the judge's order out of Ozaukee County, essentially it would be violating kind of this pledge that it made to voters in that mailing back in October. So that's one of the things that was flagged by the League of Women Voters, is that this would be depriving people of their right to vote, and it's unconstitutional. They're still briefing in that case. It's going to be early January before some of the preliminary briefing is done on that case. Judge James Peterson, I believe, is the federal judge assigned to that case. He's actually handled a lot of voting rights cases in Wisconsin. We're not going to have like a decision on that tomorrow. We've got another week or so yet anyway.
And that's the federal one. Any idea on when or if this would end up in the state Supreme Court?
So I don't know what's going to happen first, whether the State Court of Appeals is going to take some action on this or the State Supreme Court is going to take it immediately. The State Supreme Court is asking for briefs from the parties on whether they should take this case immediately. I mean, it's a friendly venue, the State Supreme Court is, for the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. It's a conservative majority on the State Supreme Court. There's a 5-2 majority on the court. Although Justice Dan Kelly did announce, I believe a couple weeks ago, said that he would not sit on this case. He didn't have to provide any additional information on why. But even without Justice Kelly on the case, he is one of the court's conservatives, and he is up for election in April, which could have been a factor in why he doesn't want to hear this case. But you still have a 4-3 conservative majority on the state Supreme Court, so it will end up there, I presume. One way or another, it's just a matter of like how soon it gets there.
Sean, thanks for joining us on New Year's.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. We talked to him about the State Elections Commission deadlock over whether to remove many people, a couple hundred thousand of people, off the voter rolls per a judge's order. Coming up, one of the brightest stars in the sky has quickly faded. Astronomers say something really big might be about to happen. We'll find out what that is coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about Beetlejuice, not the movie with Michael Keaton, but a very bright, or formerly bright, star in the sky. We'll find out why it might not be around too much longer. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a question about the holiday cocktail known as the Tom and Jerry.
Every season has its cocktails. In the summer, it's gin and tonic with a twist of lime, a margarita, or a Long Island iced tea. When the temperature drops and the snow piles up, people want a little more warmth, like a hot buttered rum or spiced mulled wine. During the holiday season, folks in Wisconsin turn to a hot drink known as the Tom and Jerry to warm them up. That got listener Pam Stokowski of Whitewater wondering.
Is Tom and Jerry's a Wisconsin thing?
We were intrigued and decided this topic needed some serious research. So we asked someone who has spent some time studying the cocktail.
Down on the corner, the crowd is so merry. I wind up by having about 12 Tom and Jerry.
Well, maybe someone who has a slightly more scholarly approach.
My name is Jim Drager. I wrote a book for the Wisconsin Historical Society called Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries.
We thought Drager might know if the Tom and Jerry is unique to Wisconsin and why that's so.
I think there are a couple of reasons why it's a Wisconsin thing. First of all, it's basically a farm-based drink because it has dairy and eggs in it and butter in it. So, you know, for us Wisconsinites, that hits home to that sweet spot in our heart for dairy. And I think the other reason is because it's a drink that has brandy in it. And as we all know, Wisconsin has a thing for brandy.
So we have a dairy connection and the Sconny favorite, brandy. But did the Tom and Jerry originate here, or does it come from somewhere else?
There is an American mixologist named Jerry Thomas who claimed credit for it in the 1860s. He published a recipe for it in the first cocktail book written in the United States, but historians have demonstrated that was around before Jerry got his hands on it. There's actually a known origin for it. In the 1820s, a London playwright created the drink to popularize a play that he had written that had two characters named Tom and Jerry in them. And it just took off from that point and became popular.
The play was called Tom and Jerry, or Life in London, by William Moncrief. It was quite popular at the time, running for over 2 years in London before coming to America. The Domino Bar in Wausau specializes in making Tom and Jerry's, serving over 4,000 of the hot concoction between Thanksgiving and New Year. Bar owner Dan Bauer is not sure if the Tom and Jerry is a Wisconsin thing or not, but he does say,
I know they're very popular around here, especially when it gets cold. The colder it gets, the better it gets. Warms you up inside.
Bauer says the tradition of making Tom and Jerry's over the holidays started at the Domino sometime in the 80s and gets bigger every year. Bartender Donna Seidler put one together Domino style.
We have the bowl of the Tom and Jerry mix. We do a swoop and spoon of the top secret batter. And then we add a shot of dark rum and brandy. And we have to make sure the water is rapidly boiling. And as we pour that in the cup, give it a couple of stirs. It's nice and frothy on top. Top it off with some of the sprinkles. And that is a Tom and Jerry.
Lovely.
If you can't make it to the Domino during the holiday season, you can make Tom and Jerry's at home. Just don't forget to get a tub of batter from the market.
No, I didn't forget. The tree is up and the Tom and Jerry mix is in the refrigerator.
So gather around the fireplace with your family and friends, light the tree, and enjoy the season.
What'll you have, lad?
Whatever you're having, sir.
I'm having Tom and Jerry myself.
Special thanks to Rob Mentzer for his help with this piece. This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question, and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to wpr.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, stargazers, over the last couple of months, have you noticed anything kind of off about the constellation Orion, in particular the normally bright red star that makes up its right shoulder? It's called Betelgeuse, sometimes pronounced Betelgeuse. It's been getting, apparently, dimmer and dimmer. In fact, astronomers say it hasn't been this dim in nearly 100 years. And some of them believe it might be nearing the end of its life as a star. If they're right, we might be in for a pretty big show here on Earth. But it might not be super soon. Chris Janssen is the planetarium director of the Wausau School District. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, I understand you're not just a star watcher in general. You are a particular fan of this particular star, Betelgeuse.
Oh, yeah. I mean, anyone who's an astronomer, this is the 10th brightest star in the sky. And I remember trying to watch this one since I was 12, waiting. Is it going to go? Is it going to go? Supernova at any time. of course, stars' lives, it could go at plus or minus 100,000 years. But, you know, it doesn't stop me from watching.
Now, what is it about Betelgeuse that made it, even before this latest news, made it a prospect for something that might go supernova?
The biggest deal really is its mass, kind of stellar dynamics 101. The mass of the star determines the squeeze at the core. And the heavier the star, the faster it burns through its fuel and the quicker it's going to meet its end. And Betelgeuse is 12 times more dense than the sun. It's just massive. The star, if it were in our solar system, it would stretch almost out to Jupiter, just the star. So it's this huge, massive star, and it's in a supergiant stage. So it has a color to it. Most stars, you can't tell a color. And this particular star is just so big and beautiful, and it's easy to spot in our sky. And of all the stars, there's the couple that matches criteria of an elderly star that could go supernova at any moment.
And this is a kind of, this is a red giant, is that right?
Yeah, red supergiant.
Red supergiant.
The difference is a smaller star becomes a red giant, and the really big stars become red supergiant. It's just a semantic thing.
Now, in October, apparently it started to fade. It doesn't even crack the top 20 brightest stars. What's going on there?
Yeah, this is really strange. Betelgeuse, or it was Betelgeuse, is sometimes pronounced, is a variable star. And so it oscillates about a whole magnitude of brightness, typically being at it's what's called 0.5 magnitude. And what has happened is it has decreased a full magnitude below, its normal average. So it's went from the 10th brightest star in the sky to now the 22nd brightest star in the sky. So it really moved down, and it hasn't done this before. And it's a The reason it's variable is the star is getting bloated and then shrinking, and it has puffed out this cloud of material that's 250 times the size of the star. So Betelgeuse is inside of this massive cloud of material, and so it's puffing off material. It has changed color over the last thousands of years. Ptolemy recorded it as kind of a rusty color, and now we're starting to see this dimming effect. So the star is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, which means the core is starting to lose its muster. It's losing its power. So is this a pre-collapse, a pre-supernova hiccup? That's what everyone's holding their breath for right now.
Talking to Chris Janssen, planetarium director of the Wausau School District. We might be holding our breath for a while, Chris, because this is soon in terms of, like, space, right, astronomical time. It may not be soon in terms of the span of a human life.
Yeah. Yeah, we're talking, I think the numbers I've seen is about 100,000 years is a blink of an eye. This star is about 8 million years old, which in stars' lives is crazy young. So these superstars, it's like the Charlie Sheen of stars. It lives really fast and dies young. And so 8 million years, 100,000 years of that is a small blink of an eye. For us, of course, it's massive, the length of time. Doesn't stop us from looking if it were to go supernova.
Now, staying with timing, it's also possible, right, that it already has because, this is 600-ish light years away. Like, if it blew up 600 years ago, we would just start seeing it soon.
Yes, yeah. And I was just thinking, if it went supernova, soon, that it was the year 1377 for us humans. That was before telescopes, before math, or calculus. It was... we were in a completely different mindset. We didn't even think, we thought the Earth was the center of the universe in 1377. And so when it actually exploded, we were in infancy of our science. And to wait 600 years later to see it is pretty cool. We might be able to detect it nowadays. We have neutrino collectors around planet Earth in the ice and deep in caverns in Japan and things. And moments before the star goes supernova, neutrinos burst from the core, and they're not really stopped by mass. So the explosion has to deal with the matter of the star, but neutrinos, they just sail right through it. And so our neutrino detectors would actually tell us, we have a supernova in progress, moments before we would all turn our telescopes and maybe catch it live.
Wow.
Which would be quite an amazing spot.
And let's talk about what we would see if, again, during our lifetime, we had this show of a star, the size and distance of Betelgeuse having a supernova. What would it look like from Earth?
The explosion would happen, and it would increase in brightness. I think I've been told about the brightness of the full moon.
Wow.
So we would, even in the blue sky, you'd be able to see it up. If it happened in summer, and it would be in the blue sky, we would see the star Betelgeuse, the bright star in the blue sky. At night, you could go out and read books by it. It would just be so incredibly bright. And the cool thing about this star is we'd see this amazingly bright thing, and there's no consequences for us because we're way outside of the supernova kill radius. So it's just going to be this amazing show with no real consequences for us, just a great thing to watch.
And briefly, Chris, how often have we gotten to see direct evidence of a supernova from our vantage point on Earth?
Through telescopes, we see them fairly often. We see them in other galaxies as well. We use them as standard candles to determine distances to other galaxies. As far as the human eye is concerned, there's really only two. Tycho Brahe in the 16th century, he saw one with the naked eye called Brahe's supernova. And then there was a Chinese supernova 2,000 years ago. That's the Crab Nebula now. So really only two instances of the human eye spectacle. 1987A was one of the first ones we saw with the telescope live. But they're a little more common with telescopes today.
All right. Well, it could happen in our lifetime. Might be 100,000 years. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, it was a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's Chris Janssen, director of the Wausau School District Planetarium. We talked about the giant red star Betelgeuse, which is part of the constellation Orion. It's been getting dimmer and dimmer in the last couple of months. Some astronomers say that might be a sign of a supernova on the way. As Chris said, if it happened and we got to see it in our lifetime, it would be as bright as, maybe brighter than, the full moon. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show, get a Rose Bowl recap and give us your reactions to today's game with Keely Baltina and her guest. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, imagine it's 2050. You're scanning through your radio channels or your streaming services or your mental music brain implant, I don't know, and you land in the oldies channel playing turn-of-the-century hits, music from the 90s, 0s, and 10s. What song are they playing? Is it some Taylor Swift, Radiohead, Drake? Joining us now to talk about the oldies of the future is Chris Malamphy. He's a chart analyst and pop critic who writes about the intersection of culture and commerce and popular music. Over at Slate.com, he hosts the Hit Parade podcast and writes their Why Is This Song Number One series. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure thing, Rob. How are you?
Good. How are you doing today? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. I'm just fine.
It seems like it would be really hard to predict the songs of the future. I wonder if first we can learn lessons from the past. Do you see, when you look back at the 60s or 70s or 80s, things that make a song have that staying power that ends up on the oldies station?
You know, it's really hard to tell because it's the charts, which is what I cover on Hit Parade, my podcast, as well as my writing, give you some guide, obviously. If something spends weeks and weeks at number one, there's a pretty good chance that it's going to endure. But we've seen, you know, some very long-lasting hits that were not big hits on the chart the first time around. I think of a song from the early 80s like I Melt With You by Modern English, which never even cracked the U.S. Top 40 and now is played on the radio every day. Or a song like Don't Stop People Even by Journey, which was a sizable hit. It was a top 10 hit, but it peaked at number 9. It wasn't even the biggest hit from that album, that Journey album in 1981. And now I think we can all agree that is the one that's going in the vault for Journey. So the charts give you some clue, but there's kind of an X factor. And you know, radio programmers will talk about how, you know, with their call out research, there's a burn factor on certain songs. And then there are certain songs that just don't burn out. You think of a song like September by Earth, Wind & Fire, which gets played at, you know, every radio station, every wedding. A top 10 hit, not a number one hit. They had bigger hits, but, you know, it's a record that seems to have no burn on it. You can play it any time and people just love it. People enjoy it. And these are the records that radio programmers turn back to over and over again because they've just got that kind of joyous X factor to them.
And also, and you've talked about this in the past, the idea of, okay, are there songs that represent an era, whether we call it a decade or whatever? And you've talked about, you know, well, the 60s, is the era represented by the British invasion or hippie music or Motown? Or you could throw the Wall of Sound stuff, Phil Spector, in there. It's really hard when you start trying to, you crack the surface to see, okay, what is the essence of a decade?
Exactly. I had to analyze this for a recent episode of my podcast, Hit Parade. I was talking about the tens. It is now New Year's. We're now finally out of the tens. And I was trying to analyze, well, what was this decade? And one point I made in my podcast is that decades, folks try to boil them down to one sound, but no decade is really one sound. I like to say that most decades are at least dominated by two sounds. So, for example, the one I always reach for is the 70s. Folks most commonly call that the disco decade, but it wasn't really all disco. The first half of the 70s was really soft rock and singer-songwriters. The second half of the decade was mostly disco. Or you look at the 80s, the first half was sort of MTV-ish new wave. The second half was what I call big hair music, hair metal and, you know, diva pop of the Taylor Dane Cher variety. Then, you know, you look at the 90s, the first half is what I call grunge and gangsta. The second half is what I call teen pop and bling. So most decades kind of have at least two sounds. The 10s fell into this pattern. The 10s were, in the first half, what I would call soaring EDM pop, electronic dance music. Think of Katy Perry. Think of Rihanna when she was in that We Found Love mode, that kind of thing. And then in the second half of the decade, it was really what they call trap music, which is kind of this downbeat hip hop. Think of Drake, think of, you know, the rapper Future, think of The Weeknd, the R&B singer. That's what dominated the second half of the decade. So yeah, it's a very careful thing to kind of calibrate what defines a decade. And there's no one thing that defines a whole decade.
And before we get more into individual pieces of music, let's complicate things a little further. It seems like over time, and I'm not the first person to make this observation, that, you know, we have more and more subgenres and we can specialize and we could be really into heavy metal and have no clue what's going on in pop or vice versa. Does that make it even still harder to figure out what is going to be the enduring song, given that we're all kind of in our own musical world?
I would say that's definitely true to an extent. Although one thing that was interesting about the 2010s was that because of social media, because of the advent of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, by the end of the decade, TikTok, we were sharing songs more than ever. So when we were all obsessed, say, with Call Me Maybe by Carly Rae Jepsen in the summer of 2012, everybody was obsessed with Call Me Maybe. Or when, you know, Gangnam Style by Psy later that year was sort of, you know, the YouTube obsession. Everybody was talking about Gangnam Style. There was even a Drake hit late in the decade called In My Feelings, where a lot of people were doing the so-called In My Feelings challenge, where they were posting videos of themselves dancing to this Drake song. And that propelled the song to number one. So on the one hand, yes, the last 25 years of pop, you could call it the trend of narrow casting. We're all in our own earbuds. We're all listening to our little niche. On the other hand, when something reaches a certain cultural flashpoint, and it's being shared and shared and shared on all these media, it can have a real snowball effect. And one thing that was one piece of feedback I got about the 2010s episode that was interesting was that folks, even my age, I'm in my 40s, were saying, you know, I didn't think I knew that much music of the 2010s, but I knew a lot of these songs. These were more familiar to me than I thought.
Talking to Chris Malanfi, he is a chart analyst and pop critic. We're looking at what music of the last 10 years-ish we'll be in the oldies stage in the future. We'll have that kind of staying power one way or another. Well, we've got some music to get some tastes of. One artist you mentioned, Katy Perry, pretty dominant on the charts for a while. Here's a little bit of Teenage Dream from the beginning of the last decade. Now, Now, I was pretty on top of the music of Katy Perry because I had kids of the right age, Chris. But do you see Katy Perry having a track or two that's going to really last into the future people are going to come back to?
I would say it's probably going to be a track or two. Teenage Dream, the track you just played, is the one that's most critically acclaimed and generally regarded as her best hit. However, a song that you didn't play that could just as well endure as her follow-up hit, the one that came right after that called Firework. That one has endured as a graduation anthem. I've seen elementary school kids sing Firework. You know, so it's entirely possible that Firework will be, you know, that song that when it's all boiled away and, you know, folks are remembering Katy Perry 30 years from now, it might just be that hit. So only time will tell, but it's probably going to be one of those.
Now, you picked this song as a potential oldies hit back in 2012. I can't remember exactly when it came out, but Seven Nation Army by the White Stripes. Here it is.
Oh, yeah. And that ain't what you want to hear, but that's what I'll do.
And the pain coming from my bones. Now, this one, a little older here, but this one, just based solely on its use at soccer stadiums and other sporting events, this is going to stick around for a long time, I think, Chris.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, in 2004, when that song, 2003, rather, when it came out, it was a number one hit on the rock charts. It was not a big hit on the Hot 100, the pop chart. The charts were formulated quite differently back then. But I think we've now had about 15 years to observe just how enduring Seven Nation Army has been. If you walk into any stadium, not just a soccer stadium, I've seen it played at baseball games as, you know, batters step up to the plate. There's something about that irresistible bass line, which is actually Jack White playing very low on his guitar because he was, a multifarious, multi-instrumentalist. that thing is a brain fungus. It's not going anywhere. So I could totally see that getting played decades hence.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Charlie with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question was, does your guest think that rap will end up being on the oldies station 20, 30 years from now? It's quite different from other forms of music. It doesn't really have, I would say music that is, you know, defined by instruments as much as a beat, and then also that the words and lyrics can actually be quite offensive. Do you think rap will last?
Charlie, thanks for the call. Now, in the 80s, the music seemed more segregated. The rap ended up on pop charts, and in pop stations, I should say. I don't know what was going on the chart. It seems like it's not as distinct as it used to be. Do I have that right, Chris?
Well, hip hop has been part of the cultural firmament now for, going on 40 years. I mean, the first rap top 40 hit came out in 1979 and peaked on the charts in 1980. That would be Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang. That's certainly an enduring song. I still see it in movies. I still hear it at parties. When you think of 80s hits like Walk This Way or Bust a Move by Young MC, these records are now more than 30 years old and they are enduring. So with hip hop, we don't just have to look at the rap records of the last 10, 20 years. We have to look at the records that are 30 or 40 years old. And there are absolutely rap songs that have endured. If you want to get a little closer to the present day, look at the 2002 hit Lose Yourself by Eminem, which actually won the Oscar that year for best song in a bit of an upset. And Lose Yourself has become the psych up anthem for, you know, millennials. It is to the millennial generation what Gonna Fly Now from Rocky was to an earlier generation. So I think it's absolutely clear that, you know, hip hop, now that it has been the center of gravity for pop for really the last at least 2-3 decades, that we are going to see rap songs endure and, persist. They're also full of hooks, rap songs. I mean, sometimes it's a turn of phrase. Sometimes it's the underlying melodic hook, whether it's a sample or whether it's, something original. But, there are definitely hip hop songs that, can get a party started, 80s, 90s rap hits. So I have every expectation that rap songs of the 21st century will be played on oldies radio decades hence.
Well, let's check out one from last year, Cardi B, and I Like It. I like sexes from my exes when they want a second chance. I like proving wrong. I do what they say I can. They call me Cardi, Cardi, banging body, spicy mommy, hot tamale, hotter than a Somali, bird, go, Rari, hop up the stool. All right, Chris, a hypothesis I'll throw at you. People who partied to that song last year, 20 years from now, they'll love to pull it out and party to it again. What do you think?
I think so. I wholeheartedly agree. For starters, I just got married last summer.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And we played Cardi B's I Like It at our wedding reception, and people danced their faces off to it. So I've tested it in the field, and I have observed that it works. Moreover, Cardi B, in a way, and I say this admiringly, kind of used a cheat code on that record, because it's based on a Boogaloo hit dating mm-hmm. that dates all the way back to the 60s called I Like It Like That by Paul, I believe it's Paul Rodriguez. And that song is enduring. It's made many repeat appearances on the charts over the years. But the fact that she added this other layer to it, the hip hop, we didn't hear the guests on that, the rappers J Balvin and Bad Bunny. But you know, when you put it all together, it's just kind of a pileup of hooks. So yeah, I think if there's any hip hop song of the late tens that's going to endure, I think I Like It as a strong candidate.
Talking to Chris Melanfi, he's a chart analyst and pop critic, an experimental pop critic, as we just heard. He hosts the Hit Parade podcast and writes the Why Is This Song Number One series for Slate Magazine. We're talking about what songs of the last decade ish plus or minus will be on the oldies stations 30, 20 years from now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a song from the last 10 years or an artist from the last 10 years that you think, yeah, they're going to be listened to 20, 30 years from now? Or looking back in the other direction, what stuck with you from your teen years, whatever decade those years might have been? Did the good stuff stick around, or the stuff you didn't like in the first place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. And I know when that hotline bling, that can only mean one thing. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Chris Melanfi, chart analyst and pop critic. He hosts the Hit Parade podcast. We're talking about the music of recent decades, or mainly the last decade, that might still be playing on maybe the oldies stations, whatever form they take in the future. You used to call me on your cell phone. You can do it now at 800-642-1234. What songs of today will be listened to in 10, 20, 30 years? What do you hope sticks around? And what stuck around from your own teen years, whenever they were? What song do you look back at with nostalgia? Maybe play it at your own wedding. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard one there, Chris, from this last decade, Drake, Hotline Bling. Now, you mentioned songs that maybe burn out quickly. This song was all over the place, and then it seems like it went away. Is this one that will come back in the future, do you think?
I think it's going to be fairly enduring. It's one of his most melodic hits. Drake is an interesting figure for hip hop in the last decade, because he basically permanently blurred the line between singing and rapping. In fact, when that song was nominated for, I believe, Best Rap Recording at that year's Grammys, he actually protested a bit and said, it's not a rap song. And he's right. He sings through the whole thing. But, you know, that line has been kind of permanently blurred by Drake. And Hotline Bling just has some of his stickiest hooks. I definitely still hear it. I heard it at my wedding last summer. I hear it out on the streets of New York City where I live. It's just got some of his stickiest, most persistent hooks. It's quite relatable lyrically as well.
And Chris, do you have your wedding playlist available for us to check out? It sounds like a lot of fun.
I probably should. I think we've got it on Spotify. So if you want me to share it, I can.
Let's get a taste of another one now. Now, Bruno Mars seems like he might be a candidate to have a song stick around. Here's a big one. Now, you mentioned that cheat code earlier. Yes, this was a new song, but people compared it a lot to Morris Day and the Time and Chic and a lot of other bands. I mean, it had kind of a timeless feel even when it came out.
It absolutely did. It was an enormous number one hit. It spent 14 weeks at number one in early 2015. It was kind of the pivot record of the decade. Came smack dab in the middle of the decade as the sound of 2010's pop was pivoting from that soaring EDM I was talking about before when we were talking about Katy Perry toward the more preening, cocky hip-hop of the late tens. And it's kind of this record that blends both halves. But then you're right, it's basically a throwback. It's a throwback to the sound of the early 80s. What's most interesting about that is that in the early 80s, it was a time just in that post-disco period, 80, 81, where a lot of top 40 radio was shying away from anything that sounded too R&B to black. They were moving away from artists like Rick James, like the Gap Band. So those records were big on R&B radio back then. They weren't big on pop radio. And now here comes Mark Ronson, the lead artist and producer of that record, with Bruno Mars, kind of amalgamating that sound to one smash record. And in 2015, it's bigger than ever. So, you know, it's as if they kind of condensed an entire sound down to its essence. And, you know, I'm sure Uptown Funk is going to be getting played on radio stations and at weddings and events for decades to come.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Dane is with us in Platteville. Dane, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Dane?
As soon as you started talking about, like, lasting artists and songs, I immediately thought of Kendrick Lamar. Again, with the 2015 release of To Pimp a Butterfly and his reoccurring political and topical lyrics, I think that All Right, especially that song and a lot of other Black Lives Matter anthems that he wrote, I think they have a lot of lasting power.
Dane, thanks a lot for the call. We didn't get a clip of Kendrick Lamar, but Chris, that's probably an oversight on our part. This is an artist who's probably going to stick around with us.
Yeah, I mean, Kendrick is widely cited as, you know, the greatest rapper of his generation, and with good reason. He's put out three or more, really, dating back to his indie days, classic albums, all of them, you know, nominated for Album of the Year at the Grammys. Frankly, he should have won at least one of them. He won a Pulitzer, the first artist to do that for, you know, any sort of contemporary pop album, let alone a rap album. And, you know, All Right is a funny one. I think it's kind of the fight the power of its generation, you know, citing that Public Enemy song from 1989, which was not a big pop radio top 40 hit in its day, but is still played at protest rallies decades later. I would say All Right, which was similarly kind of more of a rap radio hit, not a big pop top 40 hit, but, you know, it's been cited as the greatest single or one of the greatest singles of this decade. It's made a lot of, you know, best of the tens lists. And, you know, because it's been connected with the Black Lives Matter movement, I absolutely think it's going to continue to be played decades hence. So, yeah, I think that's an excellent candidate.
Dane, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Chris Melanfi, talking about what songs of this last decade will be the oldies songs, the throwback songs that people keep coming back to in the future. Let's check out one that seemed like it was everywhere when we were coming up with this show, actually, Central Time, Gaudier. Let's give a listen. Now, this one, Chris, at an important time in my life, I could not escape this song, and I assume this would be one that would stick around, but I don't know. Has that one fizzled?
I hear it from time to time. It's a funny record because it shows that you can have a hit sometimes with something that doesn't follow any of the trends at all. It was the number one song of 2012. It spent, I believe, 2 months, about 8 weeks at number one back then. Was a blockbuster hit. It's had more than a billion in YouTube views. It's got a very arresting video, and it doesn't really fall in with any of the trends. Gaudier is basically a one-hit wonder in America. He was unable to follow it up. But it's a beautiful record. It's a strange record, down to the xylophone hook. Not too many records in the 2010s that sounded like that. That's one of those records that could either endure for decades or absolutely disappear. It was already a fluke that it was as big a hit as it was in the first place, but it was just kind of irresistible at the time.
Well, that's all the time that we have, Chris. Thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Chris Melanfi is a chart analyst and pop critic who writes about the intersection of culture and commerce in popular music over at Slate.com. You can find his Hit Parade podcast. He also writes their Why Is This Song Number One series. He joins us to talk about the oldies of the future, the songs today that we can hear in the future. You can find a link to his podcast episode about the decades, this decade's hit songs, over at our website, WPR.org. And on the Ideas Network Facebook page, you can share your nominations and maybe the pain of having the songs of your teenage years show up on the oldies station. It's always fun. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, some famous philanthropists have turned out to be bad people. An ethics expert tells us how to give to do good and why it doesn't give us license to do bad stuff. A relationship expert tells us how to build lasting and meaningful friendships. And it's a new year and a great time to set up some good new habits. A nutritionist tells us how to bring healthier food into our daily lives, not just for a crash diet, but for years to come. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time.